The Call to Motherhood continues. Welcome. We're here for another look into the life and message of Elizabeth Elliot, who called us to live to a higher standard each day, to not be satisfied with just throwing a little religion into life as a shallow substitute for giving God our best. As our series continues in the coming weeks, we'll hear from family, friends, and others influenced by Elizabeth's life and message. It's always good to have you with us. Well, we continue our series, The Call to Motherhood, as we think about Valerie's teen years and her courtship. We'll also hear from Rachel Saint, who spent many a year with the Alka people, the same ones who killed her brother and the other four missionaries. An extended look into some of the people that she knew. We're calling today's gathering Courtship and the Teen Years. And maybe as we think about the adjustments that Valerie made, maybe we'll see some parallels in our lives. A question and answer program about the teen years. Jan Anderson Wismer leads our discussion today.
What was it like for you without a father during those years? Did you ever wish for some fatherly advice or anything along those lines?
Actually, when I was about 12 years old, my mother fell in love with a man named Addison Leach, and I did not know that she was seeing him until she got engaged. And one day, she had come home from a trip, and I went in to see her in the morning because I hadn't seen her the night before, and she said she had some exciting news for me, and she said she was going to get married. This was in October, and she was going to get married on January the 1st, and she showed me the ring on her finger, and I remember just seeing the joy in her face made me very excited, too. I was happy. But the big thing was I had to keep it a secret until after her marriage. And the very first thing that happened was I got on the bus that morning. My best friend, I sat down next to my best friend, Joanne, and she said, "Well, Valerie, is your mother getting married yet?" And I hadn't said a word to her about, because I didn't know that my mother was being courted by somebody. But I kept my word to my mother, and I said no, and smiled, but nothing was ever said again until after her marriage. She got married in New York City, so it was right before I turned 13 that she got married, and I was her only attendant in her wedding. That was a very happy, exciting time. And so I had a stepfather from the time I was 13 until I was 18, which is, in the sovereignty of God, perfect timing for me. I needed a father then. I needed his authority. I loved him. There wasn't anything that I didn't like about him, especially knowing that my mother was happy, made me happy.
Elizabeth, how did you prepare Valerie for these teen years that are so full of pressure from peers and the dating scene begins? And did you have any worries?
I guess I started preparing her from the day she was born. I think that's what a mother tries to do. It's our job to work ourselves out of a job and to teach a child independence. And it was not always easy for me to allow her to do some of the things in the jungle, which could entail danger. And she would go off sometimes with the Alkas for a whole day of hunting and fishing. So there were ways in which I was constantly trying to wean her away from myself. And I felt that she and I had such a perfect mother-daughter relationship that I never really worried about teenage years. It wasn't nearly so much discussed. In fact, when I was growing up, we weren't even thought of as teenagers or adolescents. I never had the privilege of feeling that I was in a special class, a very difficult class. And I can remember people saying to me when I talked about the perfect communication and relationship that it seemed to me Val and I had, people would say, "Oh, well, wait till she's a teenager, you know, that's when everything falls apart and you go into those silent years." Well, I'm still waiting. It never has happened.
So you would say even the answer to the communication question starts in the beginning.
Right at the beginning.
That's one thing I've been impressed about when I've watched your family just in the few hours that we've been together. They really communicate with one another. They talk. They're friendly. They're cordial. you don't wonder what they're thinking. And that's true of all the ages of your children. And I think that says an awful lot. What kind of advice did your mother give you, Valerie, about boys and men? Her mother gave her two words of advice.
Oh.
Keep them at arm's length and don't chase boys. Mm-hmm. Is that what she told you?
Keep them at arm's length, I remember, especially one particular incident I had. I don't remember. It was before you'd gotten married because you went to Jerusalem. Was I 11 or 12? We had sock hops in our junior high. And so this little boy named Ronnie had invited me to go to it, and I was scared. And I remember sitting down, not wanting to dance all the time, and we both sat down next to each other, and somebody came up to us and said, y'all ought to hold hands. Not you all, but he said, you ought to hold hands. And we were both embarrassed, and they made us hold our hands together, and they got hot and sweaty, and I remember feeling guilty about it. So I wrote to my mother in Jerusalem, and at the time we had another lady living with us, and she was taking care of me while my mother was gone. So I wrote to my mother and told her that we had held hands and how funny or guilty or bad I felt about it. And she wrote me a wonderful letter, which of course I still have, about not doing what the crowd tells you to do and not getting on the bandwagon and doing everything that everybody else is saying you should do. And she said, you know, that marriage is something to look forward to and to save yourself for, and that I didn't need to hold anybody's hand. And I remember just thanking, I don't know if I actually thanked the Lord, but I was so thankful for a mother who gave me such good advice. And I remember in ninth grade, quote, going with a guy, unquote. His name was Mark Silver, and the thing to do was to go to a movie and, quote, make out, unquote. And I remember starting on something like that and knowing that it was not right and breaking up the relationship with him. And that at the time I had my stepfather, and I remember something about telling him about it, and he told me that he was proud of me, that I didn't have to have the same kind of relationship everybody else was having with boys, and I was thankful for that, too.
But certainly, Valerie, in this day and age, you don't expect your own children to maintain that same high standard, do you?
Yes, I do. I really have already talked to my 9-year-old girl. My husband has talked to my 11-year-old son about that, that our bodies are not our own, and they belong to the Lord, and so we should keep them pure and clean until the Lord gives us a husband or a wife that is his gift to us. So we have already talked about that, and I'm thankful that my daughter wants to talk about it with me, and she is eager to know whatever I have to say to her about it. So, yes, I do want her to keep a high standard, and I pray for that, as I know my mother prayed for me, and as she said, from the time they're born, we can start to pray that the Lord would keep them pure and would also give them the resolve and the will to want to stay clean and pure until they get married.
What kind of thoughts did you have about marriage in high school? Did you do a lot of dating? Was it something that you really planned for? And even in planning your education after high school, was marriage always in the prayers and plans that you had?
I think it was. I knew that I wanted to get married. I, again, quote, went with a guy through most of my sophomore, junior, part of my senior year, and we had a nice Christian relationship. He's just a very good friend, and I think at that age, I really loved him, although I was afraid to say that word, love. And we both went to the same college, and I was thinking that when we went to college, we still would probably be going together, but it happened that when we got there our freshman year, the very first time I saw him, he dropped me. I mean, there was no more relationship, and he didn't ever explain that to me until about a year later. We just would see each other on the sidewalk, and he'd say hello. And so I remember kind of going through agonies about that, because I thought, although I knew my mother wasn't all that big on him, I thought he might be the guy that I would want to marry eventually, but I knew that I wanted to graduate from college and get that over with before I got married.
What about choosing a major?
Choosing a major.
What did you choose and why?
I chose English literature, probably because my mother and my Uncle Tom had been the greatest influence on me in reading books, and that was my love. Those were the classes, the literature classes were the ones I really worked harder in and tried hard, and so I did not choose to get a teaching certificate. I don't really remember the reasons behind that, except that I thought I probably would get married after college, or at least I hoped that I would, and I didn't really plan on a career.
Tell me a little bit more about your college days. Where did you go to school, and were you involved in any extracurricular activities?
I went to Wheaton College in Illinois, and I think my only extracurricular activity was concert choir, which I loved. I got into it the first year and stayed in it all 4 years and thoroughly enjoyed it. We had an excellent director. He was a disciplinarian and really taught us how to sing well. I was a first alto in the choir. My first 2 years, I would say, were difficult studying because I had not been all the way through school a real student, a real disciplined student. I always was carefree and careless sometimes about my studies, so I didn't really apply myself until after the second year of school. I had a roommate my second year in college that always wanted to fool around, and she was the kind of student that could get straight A's and still fool around, didn't have to do a whole lot of studying, and I was the kind that would have to study, and so my grades were getting down to the C minuses and D's, and I got a very good letter from my stepfather, I remember, where he said, "We didn't send you to college to fool around and play. We sent you to school to study." And I remember feeling just awful about my grades, but really not applying myself until I got a single room my junior year at Wheaton, and then really got serious about studying and did much better.
Part 13, focusing on Valerie Elliott Shepherd, Elizabeth's daughter, and her teen years. Right now, let's get an extended look from Rachel Saint about some of the people that she knew, specifically some of the Alka or Waldani people. Rachel Saint chose to reach out in love, to build relationships. This is from an album produced by Nancy Woolnow, The Alka Story.
This is Rachel Saint, and the date is December 4th, 1959, in Quito, Ecuador. Just 2 weeks ago, I left the Alka tribe. Of the Alka Indian men who went on that killing raid, as I was thinking over one day, I remembered that five are still living. Dayuma's words came back, "Tell me about the living." And tonight, I'd like to tell you about those who are still living. The five men who took their spears to Palm Beach that January day. With one exception, all of those men are younger than the missionaries they killed. They all live on our clearing. The older man, the only older man, was Gikita, a tall, broad-shouldered man. His movements are very much like the monkeys of the forest that he blowguns so frequently for his six growing children. He grew up in the good old days when there were many more Alkas and many more spearings. The tribe has been gradually wiping itself out with intertribal warfare. Gikita was very glad to have his wife back. He was friendly and cooperative and all of that, but he didn't have much interest in the message which we came to bring. Uncle Gikita spoke very slowly, and I got him to tape some of the texts and legends of the tribe for me. He was telling me the Alka story of the flood. He explained to me that those who lived in adultery and sin were swept away, and those who lived well were left on little islands as the flood waters went around them. And a part of the story told about the woodpecker who flew over and pulled up the hills with his beaks and thus created the hills and the mountains. When he finished, he said, "Star," that's my name in Alka, "that's what the ancestors said. They were talking wild." Well, this was a surprise, because the biggest thing we had to do was convince them that God's word was true, whether it agreed with the ancestors or not. And I said, "What makes you say that, Uncle Gikita?" "Oh, now we know better, Star. Dayuma has come and taught us that God created everything. Another of the Palm Beach killers is a young man named Kimu. He was Mangamo's brother. He was raised by Dayuma's father after the tribal wars left him an orphan as a small child. And he was still in his teens when he went on a return spearing raid down to the downriver Alcas and captured Dawa, a young girl, to bring home to be his bride after killing her parents. Kimu listened, too, after I got there, and when we asked him if he loved the Lord, he said, a little bit, because he understood just a little bit. The other day when I was interrupted as I was explaining to Uncle Gikita about Jesus' resurrection, when I got back, I found that Kimu had taken up the story where I left off. A third of the Palm Beach killers is a young fellow named Dewey. Dewey is Dayuma's brother-in-law. His pretty young wife is named Oba, and she's Dayuma's younger sister. When I first went there, I didn't like to be left on the clearing alone with Dewey. He didn't seem very happy to have me there. But several weeks ago, in response to Dayuma's invitation, Dewey said he loved the Lord. And then later he said to me, "Star, after a while I'm going to talk like that, or I'm going to teach like that. When you really believe a thing in Alka, you teach like that." And Dewey has had a whole change in his whole personality, from a sullen young Indian to a happy young fellow. One day, as he listened to the record that says that you shouldn't kill and gives a rundown of the Ten Commandments, Dayuma closed the record with saying in Alka, "Do you understand or not?" Dewey was listening alone, and to the record machine he said, "Yes, I understand," meaning not only I understand, but I accept. The fourth one is a young fellow named Nimunga. He has four little wild Indians of his own, but he's still a comparatively young man. Nimunga's mother is the tribal witch doctor, and he's just as dark at heart as his face was the first time I saw him. I can still remember the feeling. It was smeared with black dye from the forest, and it wasn't just the smear of black dye, but it was the fact that he wasn't sure at all that he wanted foreigners in his forest. He said he would never come to live with us, and a lot of other things. But not too long ago, he did come. He cleared a place for a garden in the forest and planted crops. His open enmity and fear of us, however, in answer to prayer in just the last month, we feel, has melted considerably. And though he hasn't shown any sign of interest in the Lord, yet we feel a real friendship on the part of Nimunga. The fifth man is a young fellow named Minkai. He's Dayuma's half-brother, father of four little boys, too, and long ago he said that he wanted to believe in the Lord. And instead of coming to live with us where he could learn more about God, he followed Nimunga and went off in the forest. It was Minkai who some years ago went out to the Quechua Indians to look for Dayuma, and he lived with them for a while. But one day they refused to share their wild hog for him. Alcas believe in eating all the meat they can hold when there is meat, and the Quechuas believe in saving it for the future. So Nimunga left the Quechua village, went back home and organized an expedition of Alcas, and then returned to spear them simply for their crime of not sharing all their meat. It was my own brother Nate who flew out the victims to the HCGB hospital. The contact was that close. Nate didn't see the Alcas, and the Alcas didn't see him at that time. But now we live on the clearing with Minkai and all these other men, and we want you to join us in praying for them.
Rachel Saint, sister of Nate Saint. Rachel spent many years living with the tribe that had killed her brother and developing relationships, seeking to help navigate the spiritual side of life. Well, we have time once again to hear from Valerie Shepherd, a daughter of Jim and Elizabeth. This is The Call to Motherhood, Part 14, as we begin to think about courtship with her eventual husband, Walt Shepherd.
After my mother and stepfather got married, we moved to Massachusetts. And before Massachusetts, I had never been with other peers who were Christians and who were studying the Bible. When we moved to Massachusetts, we'd only been in the house about 1 week, a lovely, laughing, happy girl came to the door and invited me to a Bible study. She was about a year older than I. And I remember being overwhelmed by her joy and her love for life and her desire to have me come to a Bible study. I'd never been in any youth groups before, any groups where there are kids my age studying the Bible. So I did start to go to her youth group. I also, after my sophomore year in high school, got to go to a wonderful conference for teenagers. It was called New Wilmington Missionary Conference in New Wilmington, Pennsylvania. My stepfather was speaking at it, and he had urged me to go to it. And I remember, because of the speakers there, feeling that I needed to make my own personal commitment to Jesus Christ then, and realizing my need of a daily walk with him and my need of reading the Bible. My mother, of course, had always taught me to trust in the Lord, and I feel like I always did, but it came closer to home when I went to that conference. And I remember starting to read the Bible and trying to keep a journal. I knew that my mother and father had always kept a journal, and I started sporadically through high school doing that. And then my stepfather died the beginning of the second year at Wheaton. So I was 18. I went to Wheaton when I was 17. And when he was dying of cancer, during my freshman year, my mother told me that he had cancer. And during a period of about 9 months, he got worse and worse. And I remember beginning to pray that the Lord would heal him. And I prayed expectantly. I began to demand of the Lord that he heal him. And I really believed that the Lord would. And during that summer, he had had his radiation chemotherapy, and he was at home before he died. We didn't know how long, much longer he was going to live. So I remember going in once a day to talk to him, and maybe once a day. I don't know if I went in that often, but I remember always trying to encourage him to believe that the Lord would heal him. And he usually had a pessimistic view of the whole thing and expected to die. And so the day before I was going to leave for Wheaton, I went in to say goodbye to him. And I said, "Daddy, I know you're going to be healed the next time I see you." And he said, no, he didn't think he would be. So I left for Wheaton. It took 2 days to drive out there. And the night that I arrived, my mother called and said he had died. And I remember immediately feeling the peace of the Lord, knowing that the Lord was in charge of what happened to my daddy, and realizing that I had really demanded of God something that was selfish, and realizing that the Lord knew what he was doing with him, and that if the Lord wanted him home, that was the perfect answer to our prayers. And I think that was a big lesson or big step for me in believing in the sovereignty of God.
She had also fasted, too. Do you remember that? Toward the probably about the last week or so of that summer, Val told the Lord that she was not going to eat lunch again until her father was healed.
That's right. I had forgotten that. Yeah.
And I talked to her about faith. I remember sitting on the sofa in the living room and saying, "Val, how strong is this faith that you have?" And she would have defined faith, I suppose, as the expectation that God was going to do a particular thing. And I tried then to encourage her to realize that true faith has to be founded on the character of God, not on a particular outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I felt very peaceful after he died and was not upset that God hadn't answered my prayer. I just knew then that God had answered my prayer in the way he knew best. And I was thankful. It was at the same, probably the week or two after that, that I finally was able to talk to that boy again that we had gone out to school together and had never talked. And he told me, this was another step, I think, in my growth, because he told me that he didn't see any hope of us getting back together. And the more he talked, the more I realized, well, this was not the kind of young man that I wanted to marry. So I was thankful that the Lord weaned me away from my stepfather and having to have him be healed. And also he weaned me away from having to have this boy all my freshman year, thinking that I was going to get back together with him. Mm-hmm. But the Lord showed me that there was probably somebody else out there.
Elizabeth, how were you praying for Valerie during these years concerning a life's mate?
I think I had prayed more or less all her life that if God wanted her to marry, that he would be preparing the man for her in a Christian home. And that prayer certainly was answered. Walt grew up in a strong Christian home. They were missionaries too. And I suppose we can get into some of Walt's life later on, but he was one of those people who decided he didn't want everything that his parents had in the way of religion, and quite deliberately chose not to follow in their footsteps, but God brought him back again. My prayer has always been for Val, and still is, and for my grandchildren, that God will dispose of them according to his will. When I say dispose of, I mean do with them the very best.
Now that we've brought Walt into the picture, let's back up a little bit and go to the beginning. How did you meet your husband, Valerie?
The very first time I met him, my stepfather was still alive. He came over to our house in Hamilton, Massachusetts, to talk to my mother about what it would be like living at our house. My mother had asked up at the seminary, Gordon Conwell Seminary, for a boarder, and somebody had suggested to her that she talk to Walt Shepherd. So Walt came over to the house, and I was in the living room with my mother and him when she started talking to him about his responsibilities in the house. She had hoped that he could come and help her with my stepfather, not knowing how long my stepfather would live.
What were your first impressions of Walt, Elizabeth?
Very courteous, very warm and compassionate, and terribly good-looking.
I'd have to agree with that. So, did you think anything twice about this fellow that had come over that particular day, Valerie?
I noticed his good looks and his warmth. I think I noticed that. And then I went to school almost a few days after that. I didn't see him again until Christmas time. But during that fall, my mother wrote to me, and she wrote glowing reports of Walt and what an angel he was to her. After actually the day that Walt was to move in was the day that my stepfather died. And so my mother decided to go ahead and have Walt as a boarder. And my mother writes wonderful letters, so she wrote to me weekly, and almost weekly she was mentioning how helpful Walt was and what a courteous, wonderful young man he was. So I got a little bit interested in him, although because I'd just been, had just broken off finally this relationship with this other guy, I was a little bit timid and afraid of getting to know anybody else, you know, seriously. But when I came home for Christmas, I think he swept me off my feet then, because he was there for a week before he went home. And we got to talking one afternoon or evening while I was doing some ironing in the kitchen, and he was polishing his loafers, and he asked me if I had something to polish, and so I gave him my loafers to polish, and we must have ironed and polished for about 3 hours.
Those shoes never got such a shine.
They really got polished. So I really enjoyed talking to him, and went to Urbana 73 right after Christmas, and I remember telling some friends about him that I'd just gotten to know him and that I was really interested in him.
His interest had certainly been growing in Valerie, even though he'd only seen her that one evening, but I noticed that he was always wanting to know if I'd had any letters that day, and if there were letters from Val, he wanted to know how she was, so he was excited about her coming home for Christmas. They overlapped for 1 week before he left for Christmas vacation. She had come home the week before, so they had about a week to get acquainted.
And where did things go from there?
Well, I was very impressed with the fact that he called my mother on her birthday. Her birthday is the 21st of December. And from New Orleans, he called to just wish her a happy birthday. And I got to talk to him for just a minute there, and I was all fluttery and excited about that. After that, I came home for a short Easter vacation for about 4 days, and there were about 2 nights there that we had gone out with the family. Walt had gone with us, and that night, those 2 nights, we stayed up till about 3 a.m. just talking, just enjoying one another's presence and conversation, and he asked me then if he could write to me when I went back to Wheaton, and I said, sure, you may, and he wrote me one letter. Never heard from him again until I saw him the next fall. So every day I would go to the... I went to school, summer school that summer at Wheaton, and every day I went to the mailbox hoping for a letter, but didn't receive another one.
What about on your end? Did you just answer that one letter then?
Yes, I just wrote to him, answered that one letter, and didn't feel that I should write him anymore.
Courtship with Walt, Part 1. We're nearing the end of this series. Don't miss our next time together. But until then, let me thank you for letting us come into your home, your office, maybe along with you as you took a walk or drove across town. Thanks for coming along. On behalf of the Elizabeth Elliot Foundation, in cooperation with the Bible Broadcasting Network, let me invite you to check out elizabetheliot.org. More talks, devotionals, videos, more Gateway to Joy programs, and other resources. And if you get a chance, leave a review for us from podparadise.com. One reviewer says, "This podcast helps me keep focused on Christ." Another, "Love this lady. I learned so much through her teachings about the heart of God." Well, thanks for coming along today, and thanks for mentioning it to a friend that you think might be helped by our time together. But until next time, may God remind you daily you are loved with an everlasting love. Underneath are the everlasting arms